the same day as the 2026 Major League Baseball All-Star Game, Musings on Golf merges the two sports with our guest today, who stands alone with one remarkable accomplishment. Kelly Elbin here as your leadoff hitter with the Dean. Executive producer Jenna Self, batting cleanup as she should. And in a few minutes, we'll welcome in our starting pitcher, three-time All-Star Jim Cott, the great left-hander whose 283 career victories earned him election to the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 2022. We'll also look ahead to the 154th Open Championship, which begins Thursday, July 16th, at Royal Birkdale Golf Club in Southport, England. Folks, I won't give away what Jim Cott has done in golf, but it is extraordinary, especially considering that Jim did not even take up the game until his early 30s. I can tell you among Jim's on-field baseball feats is the fact that he won 16 consecutive gold gloves for his defensive prowess. And Jim talks about why he focused on being good as a defensive pitcher, why it meant so much to him. He discusses how he got into baseball broadcasting, which he did more than capably for 22 seasons for both the New York Yankees and for the team he pitched for most in his career, the Minnesota Twins. And our friend Jim Cott most definitely has some thoughts about the game of baseball today that you will most certainly want to hear. Okay, before we get to the Open Championship, congratulations to Tom Kim. It had been until Sunday, 1,001 days until his last PGA Tour win. Great playing down the stretch to win the Genesis Scottish Open. Let's hear how much that meant for Tom Kim to battle back over these last few years to finally enter the winner's circle again.
It's really cool. You know, trying to win a golf tournament, there's always pressure, there's always nerves. But, you know, I think the experience that I've kind of built over the last few years, I really leaned on it. And I trusted my practice, all the work that I've put in to try to put myself back in these positions. And, you know, today was a really cool day for me.
Again, congratulations to Tom Kim, and I would think he would play well this week. Remember, last year, Chris Goderup won the Genesis Scottish Open, and then a week later at the Open Championship, he finished in third place. So it could happen again. Tom Kim has been playing well. Why not this week for another good finish? Okay, let's talk. I've got some notes about the Open Championship at Royal Birkdale, which I had an opportunity to play last year in 2025 when I went over with seven other buddies. And what a treat Royal Birkdale is. It's located in the northwest part of England, in Southport, England. Just a fabulous golf course. The smallest greens in a lot of ways, and you're going to see a lot of runoff from these greens this week. A lot of guys working to try to figure out exactly how to play those shots. What players have already said is a very firm, very fast golf course. No one, though, knows it better than Southport native Tommy Fleetwood. And you talk about a guy who will have a massive following this week. Little Tommy, when he was just a kid, he and his dad would wind down a little path and sneak onto Royal Birkdale near the fifth hole and play the golf course occasionally. And what a cool story that would be for the local lad to raise the claret jug there on Sunday. Tommy Fleetwood is really beloved. I don't care whether it's in England or Scotland or the States. For him to claim a major championship there would be just fantastic. This will be the 11th time that the Open has been contested at Royal Birkdale, with all of the previous champions there having been multiple major champions, except for Ian Baker Finch. And that list includes Peter Thomson, who won the very first Open Championship, played at Royal Birkdale in 1954, and then won it again in 1965. Lee Trevino, Johnny Miller, Tom Watson, Mark O'Meara, Padraig Harrington, and the most recent champion golfer of the year at Royal Birkdale, Jordan Spieth, in 2017. And I may have left somebody out there. I did. In 1961, when a lot of American golfers were not going over to the British Open because of cost, lots of reasons, primarily because of cost and the feeling that was it really worth going that far, Arnold Palmer's father, Deacon, implored to his son, Arnold, To be a true champion golfer, you need to go and win. You need to go and play at the British Open or the Open Championship. And go there he did. And in 61 at Royal Birkdale, Arnold prevailed. And one of the really cool stories coming out of that was a phone call that Mr. Palmer received from the legendary Walter Hagen shortly after he won the Open Championship there. Arnold would go on later and say that that was one of the thrills of his life to get that call. Remember Hagen, the Hag, he won four times as an American going over in the 20s at the British Open. They became great friends, and so much so, and that bond was so strong that Hagen actually requested that Arnold be a pallbearer at his funeral. And sure enough, in October of 1969, when the great Hag passed away, Arnold was among those who carried his casket to the Hag's final resting place. So a lot of history here, but Arnold had so much to do with the Open Championship being as big as it is today. So many guys after him, Jack included, credited Arnold for going over there and playing. Let's hear what Rory McIlroy, who has won Open Championship title to his credit, let's hear what he has to say about Royal Birkdale and just about the whole Open Championship experience.
It's always good to be back at the Open. This is obviously a huge championship and brings me back to my childhood and, watching my heroes, try to win the Claret Jug and then coming here for coming to the Open for the first time, in 04, at Troon playing in the Junior Open Championship the week before that. So, look, always great to be back and, feel like this major season always feels like it goes quicker and quicker every year. So obviously one last opportunity at one of the big four and try to give it all I've got this week.
And if you ever want to hear something really cool, Google Rory McIlroy Open Championship winners. Rory can reel off every Open Championship winner since his year of his birth in 1989. It's really pretty cool, and it just goes to show you how important that international event is for particularly those born overseas. One other thing about this week. I was listening to Brad Faxon earlier today on PGA Tour Radio, and Brad, a great putter and working a lot with Rory, talked about it, that a lot of this week is going to depend on how the wind is blowing. The golf course is very fast, very firm. He said guys who have a penetrating golf ball off the tee with their approach shots, ones that you might want to look at. I still think Scheffler's going to play well this week. I'll go with Scottie Scheffler. There's something that tells me, maybe he got his worst golf out of the way and missing the cut last week at the Genesis Scottish Open. So I think Scheffler's the guy to beat this week. And a very, very nice gesture by the Royal and Ancient Golf Club of St. Andrews in recognizing the late Bob Bupka, my longtime partner here at Musings on Golf in the Media Center at Royal Birkdale. As you all know, Bob passed away in July of last year, and the Open Championship by far was his most favorite event. And Bob's spirit lives on, certainly, with every time we do these podcasts. And I know that for Bob to be recognized with the Media Center with a very nice little placard over there would have meant a lot to him. And I know, and as I speak these words, it means a lot to Janice that her longtime partner, who she traveled with for, gosh, so many, what, 120 plus major championships over the years, that those at the RNA remembered our dear friend Bob Bupka. All right, on we go. Right after we hear from our friends at William and Harry Golf and the Friars Golf Club, you'll hear from Jim Cott. And when you want to listen to your favorite podcast with Musings on Golf at the top of your list, certainly go to Spotify and Apple Podcast. Give us a like, support us as much as you can. Jim Cott, right after these messages from William and Harry Golf and the Friars Golf Club. Our friends at William and Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William and Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work. Planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. We invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. From Babe Ruth to John Smoltz, many great baseball players have also found considerable success playing golf. And with the 2026 Major League Baseball All-Star Game in Philadelphia now upon us, our special guest today holds a unique distinction in golf that goes far beyond anything that any other baseball player has ever accomplished. His 283 career wins, which included three 20-win seasons, earned him election to the National Baseball Hall of Fame by the Golden Days Era Committee in 2022. He also spent 22 seasons calling games for the New York Yankees and the Minnesota Twins. Man, oh man, do we have a lot to cover with the great southpaw, Jim Cott, here on Musings on Golf. Mr. Cott, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Kelly. Thanks for having me. And I'm happy that you're playing a lot of golf with my good friend, Tommy Hutt.
Well, he is our great mutual friend, and Tommy was the one here at East Point Country Club, Jim, who encouraged me to get in touch with you. And if you are anywhere near the storyteller, which I know you are, as Tommy Hutton is, our listeners are going to be in for a great treat over the next 35 minutes or so.
You know, Kelly, we can remember those things back in those days, as I'm sure Hutt did, relating some stories to you. And a couple of weeks ago was the 80th anniversary of when my dad took me to my first games, June 26, 1946. Wow. And I can tell you the details of those games, but I took a wellness check the other day. They give you three words, and then 5 minutes later, you recite the three words, and I forgot the third one. So, but we can remember that stuff that happened years ago.
Well, let's go back to that. Tell our listeners about that, Jim Cott. First time you went to a major league game with your dad.
Well, he was an avid fan, a Philadelphia Athletics fan. Lefty Grove was his hero. Bobby Shantz, who we could talk about today, he was mine. But, you know, the game was so simple and orderly and quiet then. That's what the game was created for. On a nice, peaceful afternoon, you could hear the ball hit the bat in batting practice. And I'll never forget walking up the ramp to our seats in the upper deck behind home plate and seeing that green grass and white uniforms. And that was the most amazing scene that I had seen as a country boy coming out of a little town in Michigan. And I think that's really where I fell in love with the game of baseball.
You grew up in Zeeland, Michigan, I believe.
Yes.
And I lived in the Detroit area for about 6 or 7 years. Where is Zeeland, Michigan exactly on the map? And is it in the Thumb area? Where? And was baseball always a part of your life, Jim, growing up?
Yeah, it's in the southwestern part. We're probably a little closer to Chicago than Detroit, down right off Lake Michigan, Holland, Grand Rapids. But in those days, golf, football, major sports today were not on television or the radio. And so baseball was the only game in town, and collecting the trading cards, which I wish I still had some of them. You know, Fishball was the only game. And then from my dad being such a fan, that was pretty much what grabbed my attention.
Why was your dad a Philadelphia Athletics fan and you all lived in Michigan?
Well, Connie Mack owned the Philadelphia Athletics, and Connie every year, because of they didn't draw a lot of people, he had to sell off his players to meet payroll. So I think my dad kind of sympathized with that. And then they had the left-hand pitcher, Lefty Grove, and my dad actually drove to the Hall of Fame in 1947 to see Lefty inducted. So, you know, I kind of gravitated toward them. And then when Bobby Shantz was on their staff, and I was a little kid, I patterned my motion after Bobby Shantz, who was with Philadelphia. So that's why I really became a fan of theirs.
Remind our listeners about Bobby Shantz. Why you say you patterned your delivery. What made him such a special Major League Baseball pitcher?
First of all, he was 5'6", 135 pounds. Just as a quick aside, I called him a few months ago on his 100th birthday. So there, you know, at 87, he was my boyhood hero, and he's still living at 100. But it was a radio game then, and on Sunday afternoon, and growing up in Southwest Michigan, I could listen to 8 games. Tigers, White Sox, Cubs, Braves had moved to Milwaukee. They all played doubleheaders. And when Philadelphia was playing the White Sox, and the radio announcer, Bob Elson, was saying, here's Bobby Shantz, best fielding pitcher in baseball, lands on the balls of his feet, he's ready to go left or right. And so I'd go to my garage in our backyard with a tennis ball and throw it off the wall. And I got to spring training my first year, and my coach said, kid, you look just like Bobby Shantz. That's kind of where, thank you, Bobby. That's where I got my motion to field my position.
I hinted at the outset when I introduced you about a unique distinction that you have as a golfer. And we're going to talk about the 16 gold gloves. We're going to talk baseball as we kind of balance and go back and forth between the sport that you played and the sport you play now. But you were a 3-time All-Star. As I mentioned, 16 straight seasons, Jim Cott is a gold glover. Obviously, there have been many other major leaguers who've played in more All-Star games. The great pitcher Greg Maddux with the Braves eclipsed you, 18 gold gloves. But you one day shot 75 at MacArthur Golf Club in Hope Sound, Florida, not far from where I am in Palm Beach Gardens. And that round of 75 puts you in rare company. Explain what that meant when you shot that 75.
Well, when I first took up golf, I was in my early 30s, and Freddie Cox was a kicker for the Vikings.
Sure. Straight on.
Yeah, Lace to the Street, last of those. And he said, well, let's go play golf. I said, Freddie, I never played golf. So anyway, we went out to Minnesota Valley, and I said, well, I'm a lefty. Of course, they laughed at me. So we don't have left-hand clubs. You'd have to special order. So they just gave me a right-hand rental set, and I whacked it around, and that's how I learned to play golf right-handed until probably the late 80s when Tommy Armour came out with the 845s.
Remember him well.
And said, you know, I bet you'd be more natural lefty. So my little wedges and stuff were very good left. So I gradually shifted over to playing a lot of clubs left-handed. Now I have 2 sets, but the number you're referring to, I think it was in December of 2013, at MacArthur, and I was 75 years old then, I shot my age both left and right. I played a set of tees, one up from my lefties. And so Lauren Rubenstein, I don't know if you know that name, but
yeah. I know. I've had Lauren on. Good. He's a good man.
Lauren, great friend, fantastic writer. So I get a hold of Lauren. I said, hey, I did something crazy today. I shot my age both, well, I shot it left-handed early in the week, and then I shot it right-handed, I think, 2 days later, because I used to play a match. The caddies love that I play a match lefty against righty. So I said, how many guys have done that? And so he gets a hold of Golf Digest. My friend Jerry Tardy's the publisher there. They start doing their research. And the guy calls me. He's all excited. He said, you're the only guy that's ever done it. I said, Cliff, calm down. I'm the only guy that's ever tried it.
That's a good point.
Now, when Mac O'Grady, I don't know how old Mac is, but when Mac turns 70 or whatever, he'll shoot it easy. You know, because you know Mac O'Grady, I spent 4 days with Mac, and he could play left and right. You wouldn't know the difference.
But, Jim, you shot those two rounds the same week, shooting your age the same week.
Yes.
Did you, when you began playing with those right-handed clubs, was that a natural motion for you? I mean, you're a left-hander. Was hitting the ball from the right side easy for you to do?
Well, not at all, but I think, as you know, being in golf, there's a lot of teachers. My friend Carl Lauren, who's a noted teacher, he's still, and Dean Beeman, that was Dean's only teacher, they're still a big believer in the lead arm. Yes. You know, like Jordan Spieth's a lefty, and he's a righty golfer. Mickelson's a righty, he's a lefty golfer. So they believe in that lead arm. So I picked it up fairly quick. I mean, I got down to it probably took me a few years to get down to maybe an 8 handicap somewhere in there. And then, you know, that's about as low as I got. I did one of my favorite rounds, and I'll talk about the major champions I played with, but I played with Charles Crutti down in Earl Estate in Apopka, Florida one day. I made 18 straight pars.
Wow.
But then when the lefty clubs came out, I went to see Jim Flick. You remember Hollis Stacey?
From a player.
Yeah. Hollis was the first major champion I played with. She played at Earl Estate. She sent me down to Jim Flick, learn how to draw the ball right-handed. But then I saw a little bit later, I said, "Coach, I'm coming to see you. I'm playing left-handed." He said, "How many balls a day can you hit?" I said, "How many does it take?" He said, "Well, get you an 8-iron and try to hit it over the second baseman's head." So here's a good lesson for hitters getting injured today. So I would take that 8-iron, one swinging hard, one right after the other till I, you know, believe it or not, when I switched to left-handed, I mean, I've hit 16 home runs, so I could hit a major league fastball.
Yes.
But here's that little white ball sitting on the ground, and I would whiff it, top it. One of my friends, a noted pro, Ron Laparle, sweet guy, Ron said to my friend George, "You got to tell Jim to stop trying that. That's going to be too hard for him." Well, about 6 months later, I played with Ron and I broke 80. You know, so I said I could do this. So that's what got me switching over to left-handed.
You mentioned about the caddies getting a kick out of you and MacArthur playing. Essentially, you'd play you'd go out and play, but play a full round left-handed at the same time a full round right-handed with two different balls, right?
Yeah, see, they loved it because they get a double fee. It cost me a lot of money.
Gonna say, right?
Yeah.
Did you do a lot of it?
I did that a lot up until, like right now, I this is my age. I went to, my entire sets now are hybrids, Wedgewood hybrids.
Smart.
Yep. Right down with a lob wedge. Because I have a little issue with my shoulder, not from pitching, but by hitting the hard turf down in Georgia, and it jars your arm. So I went to the hybrids, and I would say now I play my long shots lefty, but I still go back and forth. I'm a bit stubborn. There's a fine line between stubborn and stupid. But I've had too many tour players like Nick Price that have seen me swing both ways, and they say, "Oh, we like your right-hand swing much better." But I have, it's a little steeper, and I have more power lefty. But I think I'm a little more on plane, and I get the ball airborne righty. I miss hit a few too many that way, but I still kind of tinker around both ways.
So score-wise, are you a better player right-handed today or left-handed today?
Well, for the whole set, the whole round, I would be better left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that, you know, natural swing, I contact the ball better lefty, and I have more power that way. It's a more natural swing. But right-handed, sometimes around the green with my every day. I live a minute from the golf course in Vermont, and I usually get down there and chip and pitch some balls around the short game area, and I try to do equal left and right.
Hey, Jim, you said earlier that you didn't take up the game until your early 30s, and you know, I've had John Smoltz on Musings on Golf and some other terrific athletes, and Smoltz, obviously, with Glavine and others, during spring training with the Braves, they would play a lot of golf during those spring training days. You didn't, did you not have that luxury? Did you not have that desire when you were in your 20s to play golf during spring training, or were you not even able to?
No, I had no desire. I used to laugh at the guys on a day off and say, you guys are going playing golf. You're wasting five hours out there chasing the little ball. You know, I was more interested in pitching. So I never really got smitten by it until Freddie Cox took me out that day in the early 70s. And then, you know, then it grabbed a hold of me. But no, in spring training until it was kind of cool in the mid 70s when Chuck Tanner was my manager. I was with the White Sox. And I had really gotten into golf then, so he really took care of us veteran pitchers, which Smoltz and Glavin and Maddox, Steve Avery, those guys got to do it too. So we'd get our work in early, catcher seated, just because they're out there all day. And then we would go, like in Sarasota, there was a couple courses there. Can't think of the name of them, but Dick Wilson courses. And so we play golf in the afternoon.
So pleased to be joined by the National Baseball Hall of Fame member, the great pitcher Jim Cott, here on Musings on Golf. Hey, Jim, you mentioned earlier about the challenge between golf and baseball. For you, at least, what's the harder sport, in your opinion, to be really good at, baseball or golf?
Well, I think without question, it's golf. And we all talk about that, how it's being a harder game. I think in baseball, as kids, we were gifted with the ability to throw, to catch, to run. It's kind of a natural reactionary sport. You know, in hitting, like when Sam Snead, Ted Williams would play, Snead always said, well, I have to play my foul balls. You know?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
So in baseball, you have this big diamond that all you have to do is make contact with the ball and you have a chance to be successful. But in golf, the ultimate control would be to hit 14 fairways for four rounds in a PGA tournament. I don't know that anybody does that. Once in a while, they'll do it.
Right.
But, you know, if in baseball, if we hit one off to the left, we'd have to play it. So that would always be in the left-hand rough or the right-hand rough. So, you know, I think golf to me is more like pitching than hitting, because in pitching, you want to develop a consistent motion where you can throw the ball in a particular location time after time. Like for me, pitching was down and away. So the advantage in baseball is I have the ball in my hand. So the ball is an extension of my arm, which is maybe 35 inches somewhere in there, and pitch after pitch. Well, now you take a 7 inches long, and you have your arm out there, and then you have to find the center of the face down there on the ground. And so golf to me is more of an acquired skill that a lot of the kids today who came up in junior, I mean, I see some of these kids 13, 14 at our club. They're amazing the way they can find the center of the face at an early age. So golf is more of an acquired skill. I think baseball is a skill we were gifted with. And then if you dedicate your time to that, you can improve and become good at it.
So let's take a little deeper dive into that skill that you had as a baseball player. Your first Major League Baseball All-Star game was in 1962 at Wrigley Field in Chicago. What do you remember from that game? And Jim, in doing my research, why were there two All-Star games played back then? You played, I believe, in the second All-Star game in 62.
Yeah, I think there were 5 years where they played two games. And the purpose of it was Happy Chandler, who was a commissioner whose name probably is strange to a lot of baseball people. We can thank him for starting the baseball pension plan. And then he said, let's have two games. In the second game, the proceeds will go to fund the baseball player's pension plan. Well, then the owners decided that, which is surprising that the owners would make this kind of a concession, but they decided no more second All-Star game, but they took a portion of the first game and that went into the pension plan, which is what caused a lot of the negotiating problems today, because that percentage, I don't know exactly what it was, but at that time, the rights were about $1 million, an All-Star game. Well, now all of a sudden, when you look at today and the revenue is like hundreds of millions,
Yeah.
See, the players still get that same percentage, and that's where the owners always wanted to change that. So that's why we have such a good pension plan. The 62 was the last game where they had two, but I didn't pitch in that game. I'd had my teeth knocked out a start before that, so I had a big gap in my teeth there from a one hop. But what was so cool being in that locker room in Wrigley Field,
yeah,
was I'm looking around there, and there's Yogi Berra and Mickey Mantle and Brooks Robinson. And, you know, I just had their trading cards. I didn't really know them as people, and I got to know all of them, fortunately, as the years went by. But I was kind of awestruck by that.
I was going to say, that's the word, right? I mean, you truly were – you were still a kid in a lot of ways, and now you're in this locker room with legendary figures, certainly at least from you growing up, right?
Yeah, in the National League team, I'm looking out there, and there's Roberto Clemente in right field, Willie Mays at center, you know. I said, what am I doing here?
You broke into the majors in 59 with the original Washington Senators, and I'm wearing the curly W hat right now for the Washington Nationals. You spent a couple of years in the minors. I want to ask you, before the team was moved to the Twin Cities, give me a story or stories that stood out from your very first Major League appearance on the mound. Who did you pitch against? What was that like? What do you remember, Jim Cott?
Well, I got called up from Chattanooga. I made my debut August 2nd, and it was an inauspicious debut. I'll give you the details of it, but I really was surprised when Red Marriott, my manager in Chattanooga, called me and said, kid, you're going to the big leagues. Wow. And I wasn't the same pitcher, because I had, as a kid, believe it or not, I was an over-the-top, really a hard thrower. I'd struck out 19, set the Southern Association record, and then I felt a little twinge in my shoulder. We didn't have MRIs, x-rays, or something. Say, kid, take 10 days off, rest it, see how it is. So when I came back, my arm angle went from like 12 to 6 to about 11 to 5. Mm. So I was a different pitcher, and I didn't have the same kind of pop on my fast. We didn't care about velocity, but I didn't have the same life on it. Well, anyway, they called me to the big leagues, and I said to Red, you know, I'm not the – he said, tell them about it up there. Now, that would never happen today. I mean, they monitor every breath you take, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
I get up there and make my debut, and all of a sudden the pitching coach is like, what happened to you? So I got – it was a thrill facing Louis Aparicio with my leadoff hitter. But the other thrill was I was a trumpet player in high school. So now I'm warming up, and I look out in center field, and there's Louis Armstrong putting on a show between games. So that was kind of cool. But the third inning, I ran into a few control problems, and they got me out of there. And I had a little surgery on my back, and I rested the rest of the year.
Is there any – I mentioned, and you talked about seeing the great Roberto Clemente and Willie Mays and playing with Brooks and so forth. Were there any players at all that intimidated you, whether you were facing them? And conversely, couldn't you have a lot of great success against as a pitcher? Because as many games as you won, you had a lot of success.
Well, you see the Curry W on your cap. Yeah. Well, they had a player named Frank Howard.
Hondo was great, wasn't he?
Yeah, and Frank was like 6'7". I mean, Aaron Judge is up there now, but when Hondo would come up, that was his nickname, and he'd come up and he would tap his bat. A lot of hitters tap it on the plate. He would tap it a foot over on the other side, you know. And Hondo
didn't he have that long bat too, Jim?
Oh yeah, yeah. He did well against me, but he was intimidating. So Harmon Killebrew would trot over from third base, and he'd say, "You're going to pitch him low and away, aren't you?" I said, "No, Harm. I'm going to throw him slow curves so he could pull up, be ready down there." You know? But later I got to know Frank well. You know, he's such a sweet guy. But Hondo was intimidating. The guys that really gave me as much or more trouble were Al Kaline. He got hits and he hit with power. Brooksy, I faced Brooks Robinson more than any hitter I faced in the big leagues, and he faced me more than any pitcher.
Wow.
So he had a higher average, but Brooks was the kind of guy, as his teammate Jim Palmer said, tie game, ninth inning, winning run on second, you want a base hit, Brooks Robinson's your guy.
So who did you have success against and who people may be surprised? Were there guys who, if you didn't necessarily own them, you had great success against some certain named players?
Well, I would say the name that pops out, and this is an example of an experienced pitcher versus a rookie hitter, was Reggie Jackson.
Wow.
So Reggie came up from Double A with the Kansas City in 19, I think it was 67 or 68. And we didn't have scouting reports. Somebody said, well, this kid's got pretty good power to the opposite field. So, which was unusual. You know, most hitters were pull hitters. So I said to Earl Batty, well, we got to run my fastball ran, you know, it had some, so to a left-hand hitter, it was running inside on him. Yeah. So I said, well, we got to run the ball in on him. So I got him a ball and two strikes, and my fastball got away from me a little bit and hit him right in the knob of the bat, and he went sprawling. And then I threw him a breaking ball. We call it a knee buckler, and he flinched and he struck out. So I said to Earl, and Reggie kidded me about this later because we were teammates in Chicago, in New York for a while. So I said, every time we face them, I'm going to buzz the tower at least once, maybe twice. Well, Reggie, I think he hit a .137 and he struck out 20 some times out of 50 at bats. And that's not being disrespectful of him. It's just that I was a veteran pitcher and I found out how to intimidate him as a rookie hitter, and that kind of lasted right through my career.
We're talking golf, and we're certainly talking baseball with the great Jim Cott here on Musings on Golf. Jim, also at the outset, I mentioned about you winning 16 consecutive Gold Gloves as a pitcher. And I'm wondering, was that just a case of like anything else? You worked hard at it in spring training. Why were you such a great fielding pitcher?
Well, I mentioned earlier Bobby Shantz, yeah, you know, and how I patterned my motion after him. And in spring training, I was so disappointed, and I don't go there anymore, but I've been to Twins camp, Phillies camp. They spend very little time fielding for pitchers, and it shows if you watch games. But we put a lot of time in drills. It can be kind of boring, but I looked forward to that. I really worked on it in our drills, and that was because of, you know, the great fielder that Bobby was, and he won a lot of the Gold Gloves early on. If they'd given it out before 1957, he'd have probably won 15 or 16 as well. But yeah, that's a skill like anything else. As pitchers then, we kind of considered ourselves baseball players that just have to be pitchers.
Is that why you were such a good hitter? Because that's the way you view yourself?
I was not the average hitter, but I hit some home runs. I could bunt.
Yeah, right.
I got a few stolen. That's one Maddox, you know, when Greg broke my record of Gold Gloves, I said to him, I saw him during the winter at a banquet, and I said, Mad Dog, I got one for you to shoot at. Oldest pitcher to steal a base. I was 41 years, 7 months and something, and I stole second base. And he saw me later, or though the PR guy, they didn't have text then, but I think he either emailed me or called me and said, Maddox just broke your record. So when I saw him, I said, was that the back end of a double steal? And he said, no, I dropped on a bunt. I said, okay, it's legit. So he broke my record there too. But, you know, we learned to run the bases. We learned to bunt. We played pepper. We learned to make contact with the ball, and they don't do that today.
Jim, a couple more baseball questions, then I kind of want to get back to golf as we start to wind down. You threw more than 4,500 innings in your career, which is just an outrageous number. On the other hand, you've got so many, almost all your pitchers today, Jim Cott, they throw hard. They throw hard all the time, and you see so many arm injuries, some Tommy John surgeries. And you see Jacob Mizorowski of the Brewers just kind of easily throwing 105 miles an hour. Is that need for speed with the just throwing as hard as they can? Is that just where pitching is going to continue to go, Jim, or will that ever reset in any way?
You know, I really don't think it will, Kelly. There are some that do, but it kind of recycles. Now, first of all, in terms of the miles per hour, you have to understand, fans have to understand, when you read somebody throwing 105, when it gets to home plate, it's probably 98.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, was the 105 measured, obviously, it's before it gets to home plate?
Yeah.
Off the hand. Oh.
They have a triangular, but any time if the ball comes out 105, it's like a bullet. It's going to lose a little speed. It's going to drop some. So there's a 5 or 6 mile an hour decrease.
Okay.
we were not interested in velocity. We were interested in outs. We didn't count pitches. We counted outs. I'd say one of my favorite games, my first win in 1965, was a shutout of the Cleveland Indians. And I wish I hadn't walked this guy, but I walked one and I struck out none. And I had 16 groundouts and I threw 81 pitches. And I said, now to me, that's my favorite game. But yeah. Now the vicious cycle is, I talk to kids and parents and say, okay, your son throws 88 and he's 16. Have him throw 82. See if he can pitch at 82. Well, the problem is that if he wants to get a college scholarship,
asking, right?
Yeah, the coaches are, and that's where this vicious, until Major League Baseball or organizations come in and start looking at guys that can pitch. I see where Paul Skeens got roughed up a couple times, and I'm just wondering with like guys like Mizorowski, is it going to catch up with him? Like it has Garrett Crochet of the Red Sox. He hasn't pitched in 2 months now. So they're paying these guys millions of dollars, knowing that their arm's hanging by a thread. And so they keep chasing that velocity. So if you do that, the reason, and Dr. Andrews, who learned from Dr. Job, who I knew.
Yeah, sure.
Until your body matures, until your bones, your skeleton, everything matures, you can't be throwing as hard as you can. I mean, my first year in the minor leagues, 1957, I was 18. Mm-hmm. The manager said, kid, at the end of his two-month season, he said, kid, if you come up with a fastball, you got a chance. You know, I grew to 6'3", but I was kind of gangly like Marmaduke. But, I mean, my record was good as far as pitching. That's why they signed me. But today, if I went to a tryout camp, the next year I went to 6'4", 220, and led the league in strikeouts, so I picked up some speed. But I did that naturally. But if I'd had tried to do that when I was 13 or 14, I would have damaged some ligaments in there somewhere because the human arm is just not capable of doing that.
Yeah, John Smoltz was a guest on Musings on Golf back in January, and he echoes really, Jim, a lot of what you're talking about of those, the kids throwing so hard. But it is, I guess maybe it's a lot of our society, right? It's just bigger, faster, stronger type thing. But there does seem to be, for those pitchers, it seems such a fine line, Jim, that they walk, because if they have to throw, but if they throw, boy, the chance of injury for pitchers, Jim, seems today, and I guess it is, so much greater than it would be for, an everyday player.
Oh, no question. Because you like, I have a young fella, Grayson's going to, I think he's 16 now, but I've been kind of with him playing golf since he was 12. Now he's become quite a little league pitcher. And I said, my drill is that you learn to throw, you find a groove and you throw your fastball and see how many out of 10 fastballs you can throw in the strike zone.
Uh-huh.
You don't throw for speed, you throw for control. And then if you get good at that, like Tommy Browning did when he pitched for me in Cincinnati, I was Pete Rose's coach, then you cut the plate in half, and then you cut it in quarters. So if you learn to command your fastball to all four quadrants and you have a decent changeup, you can go through a lineup, whether you're pitching little league or big league. And these high-spin horizontal breaking balls, mm-hmm. they call it sweepers. We've had breaking balls like that forever. That's not a new pitch. We threw them with more wrist action. And that's what's causing a lot of the elbow damage. But the divide now, Kelly, in baseball between those of us that played and those that are playing is so broken. We don't get asked for advice. We don't get invited to spring training. They're all data-driven. You know, it'd be like, it to golf, it'd be like somebody comes up to, we got Olin Brown and Scotty Scheffler, and they say, well, we got all this data. Now you're 165 yards and the wind is 5 miles an hour. The data says you got to hit your six iron. Olin says, well, I can't hit my six iron like Scotty Scheffler. So,
yeah, you know, right.
And baseball is like that. It's all data driven, and they're not doing real well with that with that philosophy.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because certainly when it comes to Jack Nicklaus and players like Rory McIlroy, kind of leaning on Jack, not so much about distance because the game is very different, but certainly about how to play certain golf courses. I mean, Jack really you know, without saying it, you know, Rory credited Jack for really helping him shot by shot of how to play Augusta National. And so I'm sure that's something that, that you wish you had more of, that you had some of the younger players, kind of like the an Ohtani maybe, of reaching out to you, much like McIlroy and some others reach out to the legends of golf.
Yeah, they just it's sad. I mean, I'm still an ambassador for the Twins. I go there and have dinner with season ticket holders, meet and greet. But here is their pitching coach who coached at Columbia University.
Yeah.
Now, when I was with the Cardinals, my protege, my student was John Stuper. I was like his big brother. And everything about pitching he picked up from me. He went on to coach Yale for 27 years. And Pete Mackey, the Twins pitching coach, used to go to John and say, what about this, what about that? So he would tell him what he learned from me. Well, now Pete's the pitching coach from the Twins. I'm an ambassador for the Twins. They have never asked me a question
about wow.
trade your arm. So, you know, it's just, that's the divide. And I think it's almost like the political situation in our country. It's so broken.
It is. Final baseball question. Let's talk on the good side. There have to be, and I mentioned Ohtani, there have to be some modern day players, Jim Cott, who you appreciate watching, whether they're on the mound, whether they're everyday players, because the skills of a lot of these guys are really at a high level.
Well, you're going to be shocked to hear this, but I don't watch baseball anymore. It frustrates me. It raises my blood pressure when I see the way they're pitching. You know, they throw as hard as they can. They swing as hard as they can. They're bigger, stronger, faster, more ability than we had, but fundamentally, that's why these pitchers at 2,500 innings are wearing out their arm. And so the game is played, as I mentioned, when I first saw it, it was orderly. It was quiet. It was peaceful. And now it's like going to a rock concert. But I think without seeing him, I obviously have a lot of respect for what Ohtani is doing. However, you remember Rick Ankiel?
Sure. The St. Louis Cardinals yes, I do, of course.
I think Rick Ankiel could have done exactly what Ohtani's doing. Because, you know, he did pitch, and the Cardinals rushed him along, and he had control problems. And then he turned into an outfielder and hit like 30 home runs as an outfielder for the Cardinals. So, I not to downplay what Ohtani's done, but I respect what he's done. But I really, you know, the way the game has become, it started, Kelly, when I was still doing games on the MLB Network. And in 2013, they introduced StatCast. And StatCast clocks the exit velocity, the launch angle, spin rates. And everybody at the network got all gaga. Oh, isn't this going to be great? And I'm saying to myself, this is going to be the worst thing to happen to our game. We're going to lose the art and the creativity, and we're going to turn it into a science project. And that's what they've done. So, you know, if I were to go do a clinic now for young pitchers, they probably, whatever I would tell them, they probably wouldn't do anyway, because they're going to go home and say, well, he's talking about movement and stuff like that. And mom, if I want to get a college scholarship, I got to throw 92. So we basically have lost our voice. So, and it frustrates me to watch pitchers say they have a 5-run lead in the 8th inning. And I started experiencing this when I was announcing. All of a sudden, the count goes to 3-1. A guy throws a curveball. I said, what are you doing? You got a 5-run lead. Here it is. Hit it. A walk starts a rally. A home run ends a rally. But when I talked to LaTroy Hawkins and Glenn Perkins, who are with the Twins, former players that are Hawkins now, the bullpen coach, they jumped all over me. You mean you don't have control? You don't have confidence in your curveball? I said, you guys are missing the point. I said, I learned that from Robin Roberts. Here it is, hit a home run. I bet you can't hit 3 in a row. But I can get through the order, and I'll get through 9 innings without walking somebody. But, you know, that's the stuff that frustrates me to watch. And it's not the pitcher's fault. It's the way they're trained. They don't have the right people training them, except like in Cleveland, Carl Willis is their pitching coach, and I coach Carl. And he does his best to use art and creativity, but they're still kind of in the background. There's that chase the speed, chase the velocity is the number one priority. And I just don't think that's right.
Jim, your broadcasting career, while it hardly overshadowed your playing career, and you were just, well, you played 25 years in the bigs and I believe 22 behind the mic. When did you get started or at least consider broadcasting, and were you good at it right away? Or did you have individuals who helped mentor you, whether you were doing the work for the Yanks or for the Twins?
Well, combination. In the days when I was with the Phillies, for example, and rain delays, they would call one of us up out of the clubhouse, Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn. The guy would come down and say, would you come up and visit with those guys? Because you didn't go to, there's no cable TV, that you didn't go to alternative programming. So I started telling stories, and then Jody Shapiro was with Major League Films, and he later went on to run Home Team Sports. He said, you should get into this business when you're done playing. I said, well, you know, when you're playing, you think you're going to play forever. So, you know, look at that. But then we had the players' strike in 81. He called me and said, would you like to go and do AAA games during the strike? So I was working games with Ralph Kiner when Cal Ripken was playing shortstop for Rochester. So I did. Then I got hired to do some college games at ESPN, and then got a break with NBC. But guys that really helped me were guys like Dick Enberg, Dick Stockton, Bill White, John Madden. You know, they really taught me, hey, kid, there's pictures there. You don't have to talk all the time. Just tell me what's going on in the field.
Is that what Coach Madden said to you along somewhat along those lines?
John Madden?
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a game when I worked for CBS. We would have a Saturday afternoon game, and then the Twins Network would like me to be there for all the over-the-air games. I think we had 30 of them. So I do a game at Wrigley Field, Cub game. They rush me to the airport. I fly into Minnesota. I walk in the booth when they're playing the national anthem. So I got no notes, no nothing. I'm just watching the game. And the game's over, and I think, man, I was on top of that game. So I called Dick Stockton the next morning. He was my broadcast partner. I said, man, I didn't have any notes last night. And he said, Madden doesn't use notes. So he put me in touch with Madden. So John said, look, if you do your homework, now he has a little advantage, he said, because he's got a week between games. He said, if you do your homework, like, I don't want to get caught when a receiver makes a catch and he gets knocked out of bounds. And I say, well, that's a tough guy, when his teammates know he's not a tough guy. So yeah. Yeah. You all be accurate. You want to do your homework. And then once the game started, like producers used to say, well, what are we looking for tonight? I said, you know what I'm looking for? I'm looking for the first pitch of the game, because in tennis, basketball, football goes side to side. We have no clue where it's going in baseball. So I'm just going to follow the ball, and you got a big buildup for starting pitchers. Well, they might be out of the game in the second inning. So, yeah, I threw the notes away. I mean, I do my homework with notes, but I didn't use any notes, and I thank John Madden for that.
Tim Cott, let's wrap up with three, maybe four golf questions. We talked earlier about the 75 that you shot at MacArthur that enabled you to become the only known player to a person never to shoot his age or better, both right-handed and left-handed. Was that your proudest moment as a golfer? Or is there another moment you say, wow, this was the coolest thing I ever did as a golfer?
Well, I think the most proud is a dangerous word. Pride's a dangerous word. But I think as far as gratification, I counted it up. Sometimes I'll skip. I think I played with 15 major champions. Mm. You know, I started with Hollis Stacey, then Charles Cootie, and I played with Arnold at Bay Hill. And Trevino, who I believe you caddied for. Lee couldn't get into Seminole, so he's playing at Hope Sound, and we played a lot, you know, there together. He's so much fun. And then with Nick Weiss and Greg and on, Orville Moody, who used to teach guys with a long putter, and then Lexi Thompson, Donnie Pepper. My last one that I played with was Matty Fitzpatrick a few years ago at MacArthur.
What did you think of Matt?
Loved him. Yeah. I'm a big fan of his right now. He doesn't take an extraordinary amount of time.
Right.
He gets up and hits it, because I emailed Ron Green the other day at Golf Global Post.
Yeah,
I said, pretty quick, we're going to need a putting clock. Yeah, Because I said, I'm tired of spending 2 hours watching that guys with their feet look like they're standing at the urinal.
The aim point thing, right, Jim, the aim point thing, I just, like you were talking about with all the analytics in baseball, I think the aim point thing, and particularly when as a viewer you're seeing it, a lot of the players doing it on the weekend coverage, I think it's a horrific thing for golf. It slows the game down, and what happens, kids emulate it, and now they start doing it all the time, and that becomes sort of part of the fabric of the elite game. I think it's awful.
Yeah, I know when you know, I've taken lessons from, I don't know how many major, I mean, not great teachers, a lot of them, they all want to help me. Yeah, figure it out yourself eventually. But I went up north to do Yankee games one year in the pros at Purchase, Jimmy Fatsy and Mike Downey. He said, "We got a guy for you to see." I said, "Another teacher?" They said, "Oh, Pete Salata. He's a golf hypnotist." So I went to see Pete. Keegan Bradley still putts that way. Pete was no line on the ball. You want to look once or twice or three, but as soon as you look back that third time, boom, you pull the trigger.
Yeah.
And he saw the putt going in like the face of a clock. I'm going to make this from 5 o'clock. I'm going to make this from 7 o'clock. And then we're out there playing at Purchase, and it's a par five, and I got an iron in my hand. He said, "Isn't this par five?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, couldn't you get there in two?" I said, "Well, there's bunkers up there." "No, no, no." He said, "That's your favorite club. This is going to be the best shot you've ever hit with that club."
Wow. Yeah. So
look at it and hit it. No, I just, but that's what I like about Matt. You know, sometimes they go to those books, and I wish there was a tournament where they gave you a set of irons when you checked in and a box of balls and said, "Here's your clubs, here's the ball. We're all going to play the same." And none of those yardage books. And your brain is still your best computer. So if you just read it with your eyes in your brain, I think I'd like to see the results with using the aim point. I know some guys do it well, but they still miss a lot of putts with it. I still think they do better. It's okay. Like Tom Watson used to use his feet to the side to kind of see which way the green is sloping. But right. Yeah, it's kind of invaded golf like it has in baseball, and it kind of takes away that creativity and relying on yourself. I want to be like I used to say to pitchers that said, "Well, I threw that because the catcher called." I said, "Look, you pick up the box score and it never says losing catcher. It says losing pitcher. So you're the one that's got to make the decision. And it doesn't say losing caddy. It says losing player."
Player, right. Jim Cobb, this has been great. Two final questions for you. I know you're in Vermont this time of year, enjoying mostly cooler climbs, although it has been hot of late, and then down in southern Georgia the rest of the year. How much golf are you playing between your two locales, depending on the time of year?
Well, it's been kind of hot recently in Vermont, so at my age, 87, we kind of stay inside. But I would say under normal conditions, I will either practice or play almost every day. I don't always play 18 every day, but I try to get a club in my hand every day and do a little practicing and kind of stay active. And then same way down a little course called Sapelo Hammock, a little south of Savannah, and a good group of guys down there in our men's association. So I try to do something like that every day.
Let's close, Jim Cott, with a question I always enjoy asking my guests here on Musing Zone Golf. If you could play kind of a magical round of golf with three people, round out a foursome with you, whether those three people are still with us or they're deceased, who would be those three? Why those three? And where would you go play?
I saw when you sent me an email about some of the questions, I kind of studied that. And I would say for golf, my three would be Jordan Spieth, Sam Bird, and Bobby Jones.
Why those three?
Have you heard of Sam Bird?
Vaguely. Tell me who Sam Bird was.
Sam Bird, I get Bill Parcells. He's a trivia buff. I get him with this. Who's the only player played in the World Series and the Masters? Sam Bird. He was known as Babe Ruth's legs. So he pinch ran for Babe, and then he took up golf. Jimmy Ballard was his assistant. He learned the swing. So I would love to play with Sam.
Wow.
Super similar. And I'd love to play with Jordan. because I might learn something about my short game, which is where the game's at. You know, that's where you got it. And then, of course, the history of Bobby Jones. Now, if I went to baseball, I think I'd like to play with Babe Ruth, Jackie Robinson, and my boyhood hero, Bobby Shantz. Because with Ruth, I could learn what was the game like back then. And plus, I think he changed the game more than anybody. And Jackie, because I remember with regret the late 50s and 60s when we would go pick up our black teammates at a separate hotel. And my friend Bill White, who's going in the Hall of Fame this year, kind of changed that for the players. But I think it would be educational to find out what I've seen it in movies, but just real, what kind of person he is, what he went through. And of course, Bobby, because he was my boyhood idol. I think those would be three, those would be two enjoyable rounds of golf. I would say I would want to play Royal Dornoch in Scotland,
mm-hmm.
Shinnecock in our country. I mean, I know there's the big four, Cyprus, Pine Valley, Seminole, Augusta, but for 18 holes, I know that I played all of those and the scenery and everything is spectacular, but I just think for 18 holes of tough golf, Shinnecock is the best.
Tell me about Royal Dornoch. Well, I've heard we've had a few other people have said that that venue as well in Scotland. Why there? Why would you want to go to that particular of the Scottish links?
Yeah, we brought up Lauren Rubenstein's name.
Yeah.
Lauren wrote a book called The Season in Dornoch. Dornoch is where Donald Ross, I believe he grew up there. And the locals would say if it had the history of St. Andrews from a golf standpoint, it might be their favorite because it's in the Highlands. So it's a little harder. I think Watson called it one of his favorites. But it's up there in the Highlands, and it's just got with the gorse in bloom and the fescue. You know, it's a really links golf course. I mean, Shinnecock is a links style, yes. But it's not really on the water like links. Whereas Dornoch is. There are others, and I'm sure people would say Cyprus and Pebble. And if I'd never played those, I would probably say that too. I mean, it'd be a pretty fine line. I like Beth Page Black. And there are some minor, lesser-known courses that are so good in our country. I live right near Glens Falls. That was a Donald Ross course. It's really good. But if I had my two known courses, but to tell you the truth, I'm pretty happy going right down the street from my house and playing Equanic Golf Club every day. That's a Walter Travis. Yeah, Walter Travis from 1899.
Jim Cott, this has been an absolute delight, and I'm happy for you that you've had such great success at such great games, right? I mean, growing up where you did, and as you said, listening to all those games on radio, baseball was such a massive part of your growing up and all those years playing and announcing. And to be able to still be enjoying golf at 87 has to be just a wonderful feeling for you. And as you said, to be able to go out and share time with friends and tee it up. And also to be able to call Bobby Shantz at 100. It's not, yeah. It's a pretty good life, Jim Cott.
Yeah, Kelly, I couldn't be happier. I've been really blessed. The way I grew up, where I grew up, the parents I had, the era that I played in.
Yeah.
You know, everybody said, oh, you'd be making a lot of money. Yeah, that's true. But we didn't know about that then. We were more into the competition, and I wouldn't trade those days for anything.
Oh, I so appreciate the perspective that Jim Cott brings to the great game of baseball. He certainly has some strong feelings about it. And his accomplishment of being the only person that we know to break his age, or at least to match his age, both left-handed and right-handed. I can't believe anybody's going to be breaking that record anytime soon. If you enjoy the 2026 Major League Baseball All-Star Game, I hope you get up early on Thursday morning and Friday morning and Saturday morning and Sunday morning and watch the Open Championship and enjoy it from Royal Birkdale. Pick Scotty Scheffler. Let's see what happens over the 4 days and who is crowned champion golfer of the year. For the Dean, Jenna Self, Kelly Albin signing off and thanking you once again for joining us here on Musings on Golf.